Hi, welcome to another edition of the PCRF Podcasts. My name is Dave Page. I'm a Board of Advisors member for the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum, and we hope you find these podcasts educational. I'm here with...
Marshall Washick, paramedic with Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Dr. Keith Wesley, I'm the medical director for Health East Medical Transportation in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And Dr. Aaron Burnett, I'm the assistant medical director at Regents Hospital EMS.
So we are reviewing research paper that came out in Pre-Hospital Disaster Medicine in April 2011, evaluation of success rate and access time for an adult sternal intraosseous device deployed in the pre-hospital setting. Dr. Byers and company evaluated this in Virginia and looked at IO placement with a FAST-1 intraosseous infusion system. So let's begin before we even summarize how they did their particular study. Let's just get our ducks in a row here and explain what FAST-1 is versus, because there's a bunch of stuff in the market right now. FAST-1, bone, there's a bone gun, there's the Easy IO. So give me a quick orientation here about what are we talking about? Is this a...
Well, the FAST-1 and the bone injection gun are similar in that they are both auto-deployable or semi-automatic deployable. There, you press the device up against the bony prominence, whether in this case the FAST-1 has been FDA-approved for sternal IO. The bone injection gun is approved for both sternal as well as, I believe, for tibia and the ischial or the tibial tuberosity and distal leg. And then, of course, we're all familiar with the Easy IO, which is more of a drill-like mechanism, which is primarily for either humeral head, proximal tibia, or distal tibia. It's not approved for use as a sternal IO. Both the FAST-1 and the BIG, or bone injection gun, work by pressing the device next to the bone. An air cartridge then shoots the needles, and then I believe in the FAST-1 there's multiple small needles that then penetrate the sternum, and then you pull that off of the chest and attach your infusion set to that. I think if I remember right, the FAST-1 actually has a line of IV tubing attached to it. The bone injection gun, I believe, is just simply the needle portion and has a port that you attach your IV to it. And so that's really kind of the down and dirty between the various devices.
And as a matter of disclosure, no one here at the table has any financial interest in any one of these companies?
None whatsoever.
Correct.
Okay. Tell us about how they designed this study in Portsmouth.
Well, this was a study done by a paramedic service in Virginia, essentially, I think, looking at after they began to deploy the device, wanted to look at its success rate. It was a one-year study. They trained their paramedics in the use of it, and over the course of the following year, 41 times it was used. This was limited primarily to, or actually only to, patients in cardiac arrest. What they then found was that 30 or 73% of those were placed successfully. Now, these are just devices. Generally, you make one attempt, and you only have one sternum, and so you make one attempt and you either get it in or you don't. But what they found the mean time to successful placement was 67 seconds, so a little over a minute for 28 attempts. Three of the 31 attempts didn't have any times recorded. And then they listed the various types of difficulties that the paramedics had. They listed difficulty with adhesive after the device was in there, failure of the needles to retract, and the operator had to pull the device out of the skin. That happened a couple of times. One event where there just was slow flow. Again, what they found was placed successfully 73% of the time. Now, so the question is, really, What about the other? What about the failures? What was the cause of the failures? I think the most common thing that we've experienced with either back when we, with manual IO or some of the or with the easy IO in the extremities is usually either it going it too far and infusing or infiltrating or improper landmark location and just simply not placing it in the proper position. What they actually found with this was that the majority of failures was a failure of the device to actually discharge. So when they pressed down and pulled the triggering mechanism, it just simply failed to work. Now, in all disclosure, I did do some research on this, and this device is not the current version of this device being marketed there, and you wonder if this service's results didn't play possibly some role in changing it. Don't know. At the end of the day, however, this service did elect to place this device in their toolbox, and they actually state that in there as part of their conclusions.
They conclude that it's a valuable tool. I just respectfully looked at that 73% success rate and thought, seriously, 73% success rate to me in an IO instrument when you need vascular access is just a very low percentage. I don't think they even made a distinction between first attempt versus final attempt. There have been a couple of studies, which I think we should probably review here in the future, that just published related to other methods of IO insertion that reached 90-plus percent success rate on first attempt. So on difficult patients, no less, and in this case, we're not even talking about particularly obese patients or other complicating factors for IO insertion. So, you know, I think we'd be better off doing IVs. Now, there was a paper we reviewed, I think, a few months ago where we talked about them the IO insertion with hazmat teams that did it under austere conditions. Now I'm talking about a lab environment, simulated environment, where people are wearing hazmat suits and they're performing these skills with very little manual dexterity, et cetera. And they were having more better success rate than the 73%. So I realize that's simulation versus a real life, but these other ones that just came out were real life studies as well.
Well, and another big question I have with this study is, so it's a sternal IO in a cardiac arrest patient that's taken 67 seconds to place. So are they doing chest compressions during that time? Because I can't really think of anything that justifies not doing chest compressions for 67 seconds, especially when there's alternate devices where you can put an IO in the tibia or the proximal humerus or the medial malleolus or the distal femur. I mean, you have a million extremity locations where you can be doing active compressions the whole time you're placing that. And we know that it's good compressions, CPR, defibrillation in the use of impedance threshold device, which gets the heart started again. It's not any of the medications that we're going to put through that IO.
Marshall's
he's shaking his head. He's sighing. He's holding his head in his hands.
I don't know. It baffles me what gets published and what doesn't. And I guess when I read this study, I was kind of more or less thinking that the authors were trying to justify the use for the fast one IO for their tactical response units and paramedics. And so by publishing a paper saying, hey, this thing works, kind of, we can throw it with our tactical medics, and it's, you know, I'm sure it's far less cumbersome. I don't know what the fast one looks like, but I'm sure it's a little bit easier to carry around than a big black box with a drill and an IO in it. But that was just my perspective. And I guess the other problem that I had was, you know, when you were talking about the failures, seven attempts, this thing failed to deploy. I mean, that's, if you look at it from a proportion, at 17% of the time, this thing just fails to work. I would have a problem with that if I were the manufacturer. And like you said, maybe this study resulted in the manufacturer actually developing a new device or
marketing a new device or whatever.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said to that. I trust pre-hospital disaster medicine to have properly vetted their stories and their articles. Many journals also do require, particularly when an article is reviewing a name brand device rather than a specific technique, making sure that there is clearly listed a conflict of interest. This wasn't done in this article, and actually I don't believe is done routinely in this journal. I'm not implying that there is a conflict of interest, but whenever I read a study that's looking at the relative benefits of a name brand device rather than a technique, I like to just be assured that there was no monetary reward involved. But I think Marshall's exactly correct when we look at the comparison of the big versus the fast one versus the EZ-IO, the fundamental difference is the EZ-IO is a bulkier device. It's battery powered, but does have the capabilities of manual backup. Neither the big nor the fast one have a manual backup. It either the cartridge either deploys or it doesn't. But yet if you go to YouTube and type in sternal IO, you'll see find several military videos of medics performing sternal IOs using the big awake. Of course, what these Marines do is kind of crazy, but they do it.
That's okay. They put one of those easy IOs into Scotty Bolliter's leg, and he smiled the whole time. I dare you to do that. That punishment.
I've done the easy IO in the leg too on myself, and I didn't do it myself. I had one of my medics do it, and I agree. It didn't hurt me. But I'll tell you, when I saw the video and saw that the BIG fire, it looked like the guy got punched in the chest pretty good. But these are hunky Marines, not old docs like me. So I guess it'd be interesting to hear from the authors on this, because you get a feel that they do kind of pull back a little bit on their enthusiasm just by reading their conclusions. Which I was actually glad to see them put the honest conclusion in the abstract. And as they said, this was a study to prospectively evaluate the pre-hospital use of the Fast One sternal IO as a first-line device to obtain vascular access in the critically ill or injured patient. The Fast One sternal IO device can be a valuable tool in the paramedic arsenal for the treatment of the critically ill. The device may be of particular interest to specialty disaster teams that deploy in austere environments. Well, I think they were being very generous because in reality, this was not a study in austere environments, and so I'm not sure what that conclusion has to do with the study. But like you said, Marshall, maybe that the authors are looking at other research opportunities.
I applaud the Portsmouth EMS system, the city of Portsmouth, Virginia, for just even keeping track of the records and doing a research project versus just what we all seem to do, which is put it on for a little while, see if people like it, do a little quick hands survey, and then either buy the device or not. So regardless of the science behind this or the number of patients and the failure rate for this particular device, kudos to Dr. Byers and the crew from Portsmouth for going out of their way to actually share their data with us and for doing it in a more scientific way.
I agree.
Agreed.
Thank you again for tuning in to another edition of the PCRF podcast.